You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And.
You want to come see us talk live on the Getting to Yes And podcast? Well, I'm going to be talking to Keegan-Michael Key, Second City alum, and L. Key about their new book, The History of Sketch Comedy, A Journey Through the Art and Craft of Humor, on October 5th at 7 p.m. at the Francis Parker School. This is part of the Chicago Humanities Festival. If you want to get tickets, go to chicagohumanities.org. My guest on the podcast today is Jason Del Rey, who's been a business journalist for 15 years and has covered Amazon, Walmart, and the e-commerce industry for the last decade. He was the host of the hit narrative podcast, Land of the Giants, The Rise of Amazon and the National Retail Federation, once named him one of the 25 people shaping retail's future. He has a new book, and it's called Winner Sells All, Amazon, Walmart.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Jason Del Rey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
I didn't start reading your book with a lot of expectations, so I assumed it was a piece of journalism, which of course it is, but it also reads like a contemporary thriller where the good guys are maybe not as good as you think they should be, and the bad guys aren't really as bad as you think they should be. And it struck me that this would have been an infinitely easier book to write, and you can tell me if this is true or not, if the ethical and philosophical lines weren't constantly so blurry.
Yeah, that's a great point. And one of the big challenges of covering, I'll spoil it, these two companies over the past decade, as I have as a journalist, and the two companies are Amazon and Walmart.
Yeah.
I had a lot of talks with publishers over, you know, who's the protagonist and who's the antagonist, and can we really root for this company or that company? And it's really complicated and nuanced, and that's what I love about you know, this topic and this project, which was 3 years in the making writing this book.
Yeah, and we talked before we started about, you know, me sort of saying, well, this isn't necessarily the kind of talk I normally have on the podcast when I'm talking to academics and scientists and that sort of thing. But really, as I'm reading this book, I am looking at certain kinds of issues that these companies are dealing with, ways they've dealt with stuff. And I'm looking at it going, well, I've worked at this place called the Second City, and we've made horrendous decisions that, you know, had laid down. So I think what's interesting inside the reporting here and in the book itself is that you really, it would benefit all of us if we examined, you know, our own behaviors inside the systems and structures that we work within, recognizing that, you know, maybe we don't always do well, and that one wants to do better, and that one also has to deal with the things as they exist. And these two companies, again, operating at such a huge kind of different level than a lot of the other companies, are really dealing with the same problems that we all are in terms of figuring out the world we live in.
I think that's right on. And I think, you know, over the last few decades, as they've competed against each other and sort of changed spots in terms of who has the strengths and who has the weaknesses and who is nervous about the other, you know, when you really come down to it, this, what I tried to get at in this book is, it's not always clear that there are people running these big corporations. They're humans who have their own ambitions, but also their own fragilities and insecurities. And, you know, the thing with these two companies is those manifest themselves in services and products and decisions that affect tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people around the world, both as employers and you know, and as distributors of these products and services.
I mean, I live in Chicago, Illinois, and I have basically my whole life. And I maybe have been in a Walmart once. There was one in Lincoln Park here briefly that I walked into. It's gone. But when you talk about Amazon Prime, I mean, I'm something of an addict. So I'm curious, in terms of your purchasing where you live, do you frequent these companies?
So we do. So we live in, I grew up in New York, the fifth and forgotten borough of Staten Island. And my wife and I and our children now live in northern New Jersey. And so we have two Walmarts within about 10 or 15 minutes of us. We have been in Amazon Prime members since the year my son was born. So that's 10 years ago, which is also when I started covering these companies. And, you know, I hosted a podcast called The Land of the Giants about Amazon. And in that, I tracked my purchase history of Prime, and it was all related to big life events. So birth of my son, you know, we went up to, I don't know, from 50 to 100 purchases a year, and birth of my daughter back up again. Anyway, so we frequent both companies. Walmart, a lot of our purchases are online, and they're either delivered or actually sometimes pick up at the supercenter, which is something they've been finally trying to really use as an advantage over Amazon and other competitors. And then we frequent, you know, some small businesses. And also when we get into the grocery space, we are a Trader Joe's family by and large, which is something that's a different experience. And interestingly enough, a company that has totally said, you know what, we're not going to do the e-commerce thing in a meaningful way. And I think they've done great with sort of an old school experiential approach.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Well, and again, working at a live theater, right? Even though we do a bunch of different things and we have these different, you know, corporate and other things that we do that are very profitable, we are nothing without that live theater experience. So you can continually have to be like, okay, what is it about this is special? You open the prologue and the first line is, quote, "The first time I met Jeff Bezos, I asked him what he was wearing." I want you to talk about this because there's a reason you started with this, and I felt very much like it's a foreshadowing of where the book ends up in terms of where we all want to sort of see how things are. So tell us that story of, because Bezos didn't really take that question well at first.
No. So as I mentioned, I started covering both of these companies in 2013. You know, I try to get access to Jeff Bezos in those first few years of covering the company. And it was really difficult. You know, the company, their PR, Amazon's PR department, as their story became a little more complicated and not just, you know, the feel good innovation story, but became a story of, do they treat their workers well? Right. Are they good for book publishers and local bookstores? All of that. You know, Jeff was hard to get to. And so I had this opportunity at a conference that my previous employer used to host. Jeff was speaking. I wanted to meet him beforehand. I was told no. So I got my way backstage and knew I had just maybe a minute or two of interaction with him before either security or his PR people would intervene. And so I tried to find something that was memorable to talk to, you know, maybe make him laugh, but also something he was interested in. And at the time, Amazon was just starting to sell their own brands of clothing. And he had talked about that in a recent magazine feature as an area he was interested in. So, you know, I walked on over. I said, "Hey, Jeff, I'm Jason Del Rey from Recode," which was the name of the tech publication I was writing for. What are you wearing or some variation of that? I guess I thought it out, but I wasn't sure how it would go over. I thought he would laugh, and he sort of didn't believe what I was asking and initially walked away. But then came back and had a very, what I would imagine a Jeff Bezos conversation would be, which was interrogating me about what I was wearing and then talking about how humans and technology could work together to help, in this case, style people.
I ended up liking that answer. And it's funny because I thought about this. I don't know if you were there. You might have been. My wife and I presented at a Recode conference where we talked about improvisation.
I absolutely was there, and now it's coming back to me, and I'm embarrassed that
that's all right.
That I didn't remember. And
we talked about Yes And. It was funny too, because it was early. My book had come out, so this is probably like 2016 area, right around there after the book came out, and we were doing tons of different stuff. And I'm sort of glad I wasn't there now, when I've gone all this journey through, you know, behavioral science and neuroscience and this work, and then talking to more CEOs and other people about building. I wasn't the business guy on the book. I was the storyteller guy on the book, and now I'm kind of both. But I remember being backstage with a bunch of these, like Patty McCord and different people, and again, not knowing enough that I could just be pleasant and have conversations, as opposed to grilling them about, you know, their time at Netflix or whatever. But I think this sort of like, there is a, and you get at this with the various characters in the book, the sort of human quality. And I think where I might want to start is where you start in chapter one, which is, and this is in 1988, when a guy named Robert Davis goes down to the executive row to meet with David Glass, who's the CEO of Walmart. And he's looking to basically alter the arc of business history with a single bet. And what was that bet? And can you tell us what happened in that conversation?
Sure. So Robert, I'll just preface this by saying I was really happy I was able to get to Robert. He hasn't done any interviews over the years on this topic.
One, right?
Yep. And he was a longtime Walmart employee who thought he would be there for life. And the bet he was looking for David Glass to make was to make just a bigger commitment to online shopping. And this was back in the late 90s. And Robert had led a small team in the mid 90s at Walmart that was tinkering around with the first online store. They sold gift baskets on Sam's Club's website, which Sam's Club part of Walmart, during one holiday season. And he really believed that the future of this industry was going to be carried out on your computer. And he didn't have any specifics really in this request to David, other than he wanted David as the CEO to sort of let the company know we're serious about this. And so if Robert or other members of the Skunk's Work team need something from your division, we'd like you to take it seriously. And, Robert's telling David, I wouldn't say was dismissive, but just said, we're going to continue to treat this like an experiment. This is a small business. And we have these massive super centers with these, you know, they were just, Walmart was a machine at the time with the rollout of super centers. Robert walked out of that meeting and for the first time seriously considered that maybe he needed to leave this company he so loved and still does to this day, to be clear. And he ended up going to Amazon and following another former Walmart executive named Rick Dalzell, who had gone to be sort of the head of technology there for Jeff Bezos. And Robert ended up spending over a decade at Amazon before retiring to a log cabin that he helped build in the countryside of Washington State. Mm-hmm. And so you look back and Robert, you know, I think Robert's in his mid-60s now, and he was very passionate when we talked. I'm forgetting now if it was last year or the year prior. I worked on this book for so long about he really thought, you know, if he had gotten that commitment, you know, maybe Amazon still becomes a version of Amazon, but Walmart would have been really innovative in the digital space a long time ago as well. And I just, you know, I just had a really great time talking with Robert and hearing his stories and his passion for the space and what could have been.
Well, again, so if we're talking 1988, the year I graduated college and started at Second City as a dishwasher. So no, there is maybe one computer in accounting. There were no cell phones. My wife worked in the box office then, and I remember everyone making fun of this agent who showed up to take a call on one of those giant portable phones.
Oh. Yeah.
You know, so because it's the 80s. So, you know, and we didn't have a website. And so and it is just it was so for him to be that prescient. And then, as you note in the book, the CEO, David Glass's assistant, printed out his emails.
Yeah. And so so David and just to be clear, sorry, this was the summer of 1998.
Oh, it's 98. OK, yeah, so I wrote down wrong.
No, it's fine. You just got me very nervous because that would be a big blunder in my first page of my first chapter. So I just checked it. Woo.
But still also like pretty early in those days.
Very, very early. And so David, you know, it's interesting. Sam Walton in his memoir, you know, cites David as one of actually the people who were pushing Sam Walton to innovate more. But the technology innovations that David and his teams were pushing were more automation in warehouses. When it came to personal computers, that was sort of a whole different thing. And I think David, like a lot of leaders back then, were it was hard to see the massive potential. Right. And again, this goes back. We can get into this, but sort of a classic innovator's dilemma story where you have so much success at your core business and it's so massive and takes so much to run and expand that it's really hard to move your thinking in a meaningful way to this new small thing. Right. And I think of that in all different industries, not just corporations. I think of it in journalism, my field. And anyway, this was just one of the classic and I think biggest examples of that challenge over the last few decades in the corporate world.
So talking about that a bit, you have the technology piece, of course, so that threw everyone, get it. But then this sort of victim of your own success, the innovator's dilemma, you've got these stores and they still to this day are hugely important, the focus. So that, you know, and then this is sort of mix of incentives, right? And it does strike me, and you write about this, we're just like, these bonuses didn't help because then everyone is incentivized not necessarily to work together.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, it seems, as I talk about this, I've been thinking about this a lot. On one hand, it seems kind of silly, you know, to say, well, incentives incentivize, right?
Right.
And but they're there for multiple reasons. And so one of the big struggles over time at Walmart has been store leaders have been incentivized to focus on the profits of the stores. Yes, growth, but operating them very efficiently and profitably. And then over time, you have, you know, e-commerce leaders who are trying to make up ground with Amazon and frankly, some other companies as well. And sometimes it's really hard to grow and make a profit at the same time in this field.
Yeah.
And so you had those constant incentive battles. You know, you'd like to think that executives at all times are thinking at, you know, 10 years out, the future of a business, but they're incentivized to win in the short term and hit their goals. And they have employees to you know, make sure, help reach their goals. And it's a complicated thing. And, you know, one of my favorite, you know, parts of interviewing people for this book was sitting down with Doug McMillon, the current CEO of Walmart, really, a, you know, to many people, an incredible leader and a real champion of the Walmart way. And he said, listen, you know, down the road, people will examine my time as CEO and they'll decide, did I leave the stores division and e-commerce division apart for too long? Or did I get it right or not? You know, you all will figure that out. But at least for a period of time during his tenure as CEO, he felt they need to sort of be apart for a while in order to get the e-commerce team really feeling good about their work and scaling fast and all of that. And so I don't have an answer, you know, whether, you know, and maybe there will be a definitive answer in time over, you know, whether he did right or wrong with that decision. But it was good. It was nice to hear a really important, powerful leader acknowledge that, like, we don't know if it was the right decision, right. But, you know, I made it and I'm standing by it.
Yeah. Again, this is the interesting thing about this book, which is really not the way a lot of people. I posted a thing this weekend that I saw an article, and I forget who wrote it on Medium. And the title was something about beware of too many Malcolms. And it's the idea in these business books where people get obsessed with the Malcolm Gladwell like analogy of a situation that then breaks down if you go into it. And because the reality is always messier. And what's funny is both of these companies that we're talking about are clients of ours. And at Walmart in particular, the work that they brought us in to do was a lot of listening work, a lot about people being present with each other, which is a thing that people talk about McMillan being really good at. And honestly, is not an easy thing to be good at, especially when you're a leader.
That's absolutely right. You know, over the course of, so he became CEO, I believe, in 2014. So I've talked to a lot of people about him over time, even before I got to sit down with him for this book. And, you know, what struck me, which is really hard to do, is even people who left Walmart may be disappointed about their tenure or just not on the best terms had like 90% good things to say about Doug as a leader and a human. And really, you know, I don't know that Walmart is in position they are as sort of listen, I think it's hard for people. Let me take a step back.
Yeah.
They're a massive company with so much power, period. But they really, as crazy as it sounds, have been an underdog in this big, important
industry
of online retailing for a long time. And, you know, they still have a ways to go. But I think without someone who mixes sort of a belief in technology with sort of the Walmart DNA, also though a big charismatic champion of the company as well. Without that selection of Doug, I don't know if they're where they are today in this battle, at least, which is, you know, fighting back.
Yeah. So the one area that you talk about that Amazon is trying to claw away rather unsuccessfully over time is this perishable goods, the idea of people going and buying their fruits, their vegetables, their meat, because they do that at Walmart, apparently. They go to the store and do that.
They do.
But I mean, Amazon bought Whole Foods. There was those Amazon Fresh stores. Have none of these things worked to the level that they needed them to work?
I mean, the Whole Foods acquisition has kind of been fine. I think...
But Bezos isn't interested in fine.
Yeah, no. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. I think they'll hold on to it. But I just think a couple of things have gone wrong there. I think they early on, they really pushed them hard as sort of turning them into also like mini warehouses for delivery people. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of Whole Foods customers were not thrilled about going into a store that they really love to be in.
Yeah.
And, you know, having to elbow jockey for position with delivery people who were doing their job, like nothing wrong there. So the experience, you know, to some people sort of degraded. And then there just hasn't been sort of, you know, great growth there. So that's one thing. And then, yes, you spoke of Amazon Fresh stores, which Amazon has been experimenting in. And, you know, they have technology in them. You know, some of them, they have these carts that you put the items in, and the carts themselves, sensors, calculate, basically know what you're putting in, and they, you know, you can walk out without paying. Some of Amazon's other stores have this idea of, you know, you're picking stuff off the shelves and just walking out. And some people love that. And for a certain clientele, that might be enough to choose that over another store. But by and large, the differentiation of these stores has not been enough to really attract consistent lovers of these brand of, you know, of these outlets. And so under new CEO Andy Jassy, who took over for Jeff Bezos a couple of years ago, they sort of put a pause on the expansion of these new grocery stores and are trying to figure out what the right way is for them to enter the space. And I don't know if it's the innovator's dilemma for them, but it is trying to figure out, you know, 80 or 85% of retail still happens in stores. What is our value add in this space?
It's funny. I think it was a couple of years ago, the Walgreens that's across from Second City, suddenly we walked in and it was all kiosks, self-serve.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that maybe lasted 3 months and they all went away and people came back. And I was like, I wonder how they made that decision. Cause I certainly remember, like, I went and I saw the kiosk, I got whatever I needed, and I don't think I ever went back. And I imagine that that's what they, and I go there again now frequently. It wasn't like necessarily a conscious choice where I was like, I just, you know, whatever. I was like, I don't know. I don't want to deal with that. This idea of, for those of us in live businesses and understanding that, you know, it takes a lot to be successful in a live endeavor and get people to come over. This is why when people are like, you always think you want to be in the restaurant business. People always think they want to be in, like, and anyone who's in the restaurant business, like, don't go into the restaurant business. It's so hard. But also your favorite restaurant is, and this is part of the reason, because your favorite restaurant is like one of the most important things to you as a human.
Absolutely. I was going to say, people think they want to write a book, and I'm going to tell them, don't write a book.
Agreed. I've written a book. No, you don't want to write a book.
What? Just a little aside, one of my closest friends in the journalism industry, his name is Peter Kafka. He hosts a media podcast. Wonderful person and incredible journalist and interviewer. He has never written a book, and he has a lot of, because he has a lot of journalism friends who've written books. Now, listen, maybe I have a sequel in me someday, but I may not have a wife and children if I do. So probably not a bet to make for me. Sorry. So back to live, how hard it is, right? And in that vein, you know, Amazon announced, I think it was last year, that they were shutting down their bookstore. So they had opened, you know, a few dozen bookstores. Yeah. And I'd been in them and they were fine. And, you know, for me as a journalist, it was kind of exciting to see them enter a new space, and especially with the irony, and I don't know if you call it irony or something else, of them opening bookstores. But, you know, around the exactly same time they announced this, that's when I sat down with Doug McMillon at Walmart, and I was kind of, you know, I asked him about it, of course, and I was interested if he was going to take any shots at his rival. And he just said very matter of factly, like, physical retail is hard. Like, you know, and he also said, which Walmart has learned, like, online retail is really hard too, but physical retail is really hard to stand out. You know, people talk about retail dying or stores dying, and the truth is, it's mediocre retail is dying, right? Yeah, you know, you need a reason for being. And for us, like I was mentioning Trader Joe's, it's, yes, it is the pricing and their, you know, and their original product manufacturing that they do. But it's really the experience, right? And so Amazon is not nailed it by any means in physical retail, and they may never, but we'll see.
It's interesting. So just last week, I interviewed Zeynep Tone, who's a MIT professor who has a fantastic book around good jobs. And one of the things that she points out, and this is so true of Trader Joe's, it's flooded with people. You never don't have a person to help you. And for so many companies who are coming in and looking to expand, they know that they can make more money by having less people, but that usually almost always never works out in the long run in terms of a paying off. This is so the Jack Welch bull that we got fed to us, because you can see these short-term profits and you start acquiring and doing all these other things, but it doesn't pay off. And what struck me with these two companies is that might have been a philosophy that might have existed at certain times, but they, both of them, understand the need to pivot over time when something isn't working.
I think that's right. And, they may, when talking with the press, they may, spin these pivots or, frankly, yeah, failures as experiments or things of that like. But, they pulled the plug. I mean, we're seeing Amazon at this sort of corporate level inflection point, I think, where they've had these large layoffs. I think 27,000 corporate employees over the last year, and pulling back in some areas a bit, where they had invested super heavily, Alexa being one of them.
Yeah.
It's, easy, even in the media business, you look at a company like Amazon to think that they're just going to go up and to the right, just growing, mm-hmm. growing forever. And life doesn't work that way. And this, I have a lot of those life doesn't work that way moments in this book, where it seems like a company or a person is something that never loses. And then, life hits them and you have a choice at that point, which is you either fold and go home or you pivot, right?
Yeah.
As the tech industry likes to say.
Well, another big area that you talk about with this for both these companies is their attempts to get into this healthcare space, this healthcare and wellness space, which I get it. It's broken. Our country is broken. It's just that anyone who's experienced this, and I certainly have my family, it's obscene in terms of if something happens, what you have to deal with. And I remember all the press reports around Amazon and thinking oh my God, they're going to take over health. And they try.
Yeah, so, and they're still trying. This goes back to Jeff Bezos. I think, you look at an industry that is hard and fragmented and maybe has some excess profit margin. And in the way Bezos used to think, that's right. That's an industry ripe for disruption. And
yeah.
He tried all the way back in the early days of Amazon with something called drugstore.com, where Amazon owned a big chunk of that. That ended up not working for a variety of reasons. And they're trying again, both Amazon and Walmart. That was actually, I'm an e-commerce and I've become an e-commerce nerd over the years covering this space. But health, that chapter about healthcare and these two companies was probably my favorite to write and report. Because A, I learned so much. I had to do so much extra reporting to make sure I knew what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And B, because I really do think both will be players in this space. How big, I'm not sure, 5-10 years down the road. And so I think all of us should be paying attention to their efforts, whether we're a fan of them or not, because they see this industry as something they absolutely want to be a part of long term. And I just think they're going to keep at it.
Yeah. I mean, I think in my, so I'm 56, and to me, the sort of most revolutionary thing that exists now that didn't when I was a younger person is urgent care. you know, just this idea that you don't have to necessarily go to your primary care physician or to a hospital, that there are places in every neighborhood, at least every neighborhood I, you know, in Chicago that I go by, where you can at least get your shot or get something checked out, you know, because most of those problems are like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, when you're talking about in this chapter, you're talking about everything from medications and, you know, and acquiring companies in there to these kinds of like urgent care center. I mean, it's a gamut in terms of that field.
And, yeah.
And complex.
Yeah. Walmart. I mean, Walmart, you know, has these Walmart health clinics, none around me in the Northeast. I think actually either they've started to roll out in Illinois or going to, but it's still relatively small. You know, by the end of next year, I think they'll have 75 across seven states. But these are essentially trying to be, they don't call them super centers, medical super centers, but essentially
that'd be bad branding.
It's not always the best at branding, but yes. Doctor, dental, x-rays, perhaps mental health counseling in some. And, you know, they talk a lot about just trying to bring accessibility to areas where there's not a lot of good options for care. Yes, Amazon was sending people to your home. They started with just the service Amazon Care for employees. I have some great stories, both positive and negative, about, you know, how they were trying to build out that service. They end up shutting it down and then, but then acquiring One Medical, which is sort of a newer chain of primary care with an app digital component as well, spending almost $4 billion. So they're serious. I mean, they're really serious. And then, they each had a battle over this online pharmacy called PillPack. Each wanted to buy this company. I'm a sports fan, so I do like business narratives that are, you know, head to head competitions. And that was a big one. And it's sort of the foundation for Amazon to launch this Amazon Pharmacy, which again is going to them for your prescription needs.
And where are we at with that? Is that a thing that's happening now?
So Amazon is still running this company called PillPack, which if you take several medications a day, that is their target. That is their target customer, and they'll, you know, package them and organize them for you and then ship them to your door. So that business is still there. And then Amazon is starting to market this Amazon Pharmacy, which is supposed to be sort of for everyone. And that is going to them for your prescriptions and having it shipped to you in a couple of days. Now, if you need antibiotics today because you have, you know, something where you need antibiotics today, that's probably not going to be your bet. But if you have sort of one recurring, you know, maybe blood pressure medication that you have to take, maybe it would be cheaper to go to Amazon for that, or just more convenient. But I think they still have a lot of challenges there to get people out of their normal routines. And also, you know, Amazon is a trusted brand in a lot of ways, but healthcare and shopping for toilet paper, to me at least, are, you know, different.
Maybe
things.
Two different things.
Maybe connected. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Before we ask you for your yes and story, there's one character we haven't mentioned who I was really compelled because I didn't. When you introduced us to Mark Lohr, I sort of had one idea that I wasn't going to like this guy, and I kind of like this guy.
Listen, it's pronounced Mark Laurie.
It's Laurie. Thank you.
Yeah. Which I took me 2 years of covering him to recognize that. So, no blame on you there.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's an entrepreneur who, was the founder of diapers.com back in the day. And actually, you know, there's an Amazon Walmart battle there. Walmart was interested. Amazon ended up, making that deal. And he and his co-founder actually were really struggled with that decision because Walmart at one point came and offered a lot more money, but they were frankly, I think they were intrigued by the tech nature of Amazon over Walmart, but also they were a little scared of what would happen if they didn't sell the Amazon in terms of
well, there was some real pressure put on them.
There's a real pressure put on them. So and then he started this company called Jet.com, which was after he left Amazon, or though some people will say he was kind of working on it while he was still at Amazon. And yeah, they were trying to sort of make a run at Amazon, but also Walmart, and felt there was a real opportunity to become the number two biggest online retailer. That chapter is one of my favorite ones too, because it's the wild story of this startup over a year and a half that raised a ton of venture capital. The business is kind of not working, but they just keep putting money into it. And he's a great salesman and also, you know, brilliant in a lot of ways. And they've, you know, they're kind of running out of cash, but Walmart really needs a jolt in their e-commerce business, and comes along and not only pays $3 billion for Jet.com, but hands the keys to their online kingdom to Mark and his team. And a lot of things Mark Lorien team did at Walmart, one-off decisions did not work, but a main thing they were trying to do, and you can call it salesmanship or I don't know what, but they were trying to change the narrative of Walmart and technology. And I think in a lot of ways they succeeded.
Yeah.
Both, you know, they grew that business, whether it was done profitably or not. That was a big tension inside the company. The cultures of the stores and e-commerce teams were a big tension. But on Wall Street, and I think in the tech industry, they did change the narrative and put Walmart into a better position to continue to take on Amazon in this battle. I'm curious for you. What made you think you might not like him? And then what sort of changed your mind a bit if it did?
Well, it sort of felt at the beginning like he was full of BS, like he was just a P.T. Barnum type guy. And when you look back at the companies, they never quite work. And so it's sort of like, well, what? I saw that you made a bunch of money on this deal, but are people getting their, you know, is this work? Is it profitable?
Yep.
But then over time, when you sort of realize that this is another sort of character in the book who understands the importance of human to human relationships, trying to change culture. I also had sympathy because while you don't come out right and say this, you do imply that a little bit of like, this is a guy who maybe attempted some comedy without a license. It's a line I use quite often, which is the jokes or the behavior in this. And look, I know about the Walmart culture in terms of, I know people work there, and it didn't take kindly to necessarily a guy like that expressing himself in the ways that he expressed himself. And that's difficult because there are incredible benefits to using humor and sort of that sort of the different kinds of personalities, which you need. And again, this goes back to my very first sort of observations around the book, because Amazon's got this culture of, you know, disagree. It's important to disagree, which is fantastic. But also when you marry that with real bad ethics, it's not so good. And then Walmart has this sort of classic traditional American value thing, sort of, when married with questionable ethics, is not good. So this is just always going to be, it's funny. I was talking to my friend Jen, who works across the hall, just in the sense of the many of the narratives that we see coming around in the podcasts we listen to that are talking about this stuff, which do end up like really wondering about capitalism in this country. And then it's like, okay, I have my questions about it as well, but like, what else do we got? Like, I don't see another system being sort of great. And I mean, so this is hard, right? It's hard to like, how long do we keep at it where we're like, no, we're going to get this right.
Yeah. I mean, and, you're right on. And, you know, in this book, you know, so this battle is ongoing, right? And I knew from the time I sold this book, and I was straight with my publisher about this, like, I don't know where this book ends, because this battle is not over. And I sort of end, you know, I won't give too much away, but, you know, I sort of end with like, listen, I hope this competition continues to have some, throw off some positives, right? Each company feels like they need to compete by raising wages a bit, or, you know, maybe they will make improvements to healthcare, or try to think what else. Maybe they will bring new innovations that make life easier. But there's all, but there's buts with all of that, right? And you know, and so it's yeah, I'm with you on like what do we have that's better? And I really, the other thing is, you know, I struggle with it being on consumers, you know, us and our life as consumer. I hate just using that term as
right.
Calling people, like people, people are complicated, right? We're not just buyers.
We're talking about content and storytelling. All right.
Oh man. I mean, I won't go off on that, but anyway, I don't know that it's up to us in our busy lives to, you know, upend the, you know, the way the economy works in this, in our society, and what's convenient and what's not. But I think it's important to understand how these companies operate, the types of people who run them, what their motivations are, both good and bad, and at least, you know, be straight with what might not be right about how they operate day to day. And with that, we can at least be informed and make the best decisions for the important people in our life, which is, you know, how I try to live, at least.
I love it. We always end the podcast with asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one?
I think I do. I started working on the book proposal for Winner Sells All in 2019. I'm working on it.
What month?
That's a good question. Ooh, I should know the month. Well, I published something in, I believe, May of that year about the history of Amazon Prime, and that got the attention of the book world. You know, some folks.
Okay,
in the book
this is after shutdown.
Sorry, so 2019, so before shutdown. But I'm still working on it as the world.
I'm writing,
and then March hits of 2020, and I'm writing for my day job, you know, at Recode and Vox.com, trying to cover what this means for, you know, the retail world. And on April 7th, I get an email in my inbox from my agent that is, hey, Jason, this may not be the best time, but I do think you should get back to that proposal, because e-commerce is pretty important right now, and it would be a good time to get a proposal out to the publishers in this world about this big battle and the future of this industry that is becoming, you know, really a necessity, right, for those, at least those early months, and still for a lot of people. And I think I may have taken a day and I said, yes, Ethan, you're right. And I will start in the next few days returning to this proposal. And I think within about 4 to 6 weeks, we had finished a abridged version of what we initially planned pre-pandemic, about 40 pages instead of 80 pages. Got it out to publishers, I think, in June. And, you know, I think by the end of that month, had signed a deal with Harper Business to publish this thing. And it'll see the light of day, finally. Some questionable moments over those 3 years. But I'm very, very glad I said yes, and I actually followed through on it and finished that darn thing.
I love it. So my book was also published by Harper's Business, and but it was not called Yes And. When we sold it, it was called The Revolution Will Be Improvised, which I still love that title. But I remember we led the marketing team through an improv workshop. It was, I think, our publisher's idea, our editor. And we taught them the Yes And exercise, and they're all like, you need to call the book Yes And. Which was prescient, they because it did really well, and I think it was in part because that was a concept that tech had embraced in part because Stanford produces so many people and they do a lot of improv over there. And literally at Zappos, they had a thing called the Yes And Library. Taught a workshop. I'm like, wait a second, that's my book. But hadn't permeated the rest of the culture, which it has now. So it's kind of interesting where these things end up. Well, I love this book. It's called Winner Sells All: Amazon, Walmart, and the Battle for Our Wallets. Jason, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Kelly. I had a great time.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.